up with Rocker Mike and Rob Rossi. I'm getting loved up with Rocker Mike and Rob Rossi. Well, I'm loved up, but I'm okay. It's gonna get loved up anyway. You better call back the posse. Just getting loved up with Rocker Mike and Rob Rossi. Getting loved up with Rocker Mike and Rob Rossi.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Rocker Mike and Rob Presents. I'm Rocker Mike. The big guy on the top left is Rob Rossi. And we have a special guest today, film director April Jones. She came across our radar because we did a show on the band The Mentors. You might remember that from a couple of months ago. She made a fantastic film called The Kings of Sleaze, the story of The Mentors.
That was fantastic, too.
Yeah, and I was really blown away by the film. I'm a big Mentors fan. Everybody knows that. But she's got some other stuff coming out, a film called Concrete Law about skateboard parks. It's very interesting. Welcome to the show, April.
Hell yeah. Thanks for having me, guys.
Cool. So let's just jump right in and let's get a little background on you, okay? How did you get into film?
So, born in Modesto, moved to Portland in like early 2000s. I wanted to go to film school, but I was too poor. So I walked into the public access station and was like, hey, can I volunteer? I don't have any camera equipment. I don't have any laptop, but I want to learn. They put me to work. I was volunteering on everything from like political talk show to like gospel, Christian gospel, like turning my shirt inside out because I want to get camera experience, but like every metal shirt I have is like satanic. I'm not like quite, you know, professional attire yet.
Can't wear a Mentor shirt for something like that.
Actually, back then you could have gotten away with wearing a Mentor shirt in Portland. This was like 2008-09 or so. Right. So like before high definition, they put me in the TV studio, the public access TV studios. I was working with these big broadcasting cameras, like live streaming. I started live streaming metal shows and punk shows. Mm-hmm. I mean, to where like this chick was like pissing in this dude's mouth on stage and I'm like zooming in trying to like get it. Yeah, it was like all, and so these collections of me just going out and filming shows became a heavy metal public access TV series called Slade and Organ. And I produced about 40 short episodes on a $0 budget. I probably interviewed like 50 or 60 people in like 6 years. I just went, it was like every night. It's funny, the goal wasn't to like create that much content. It was like, how am I gonna get to these shows for free? I've got to meet all my like idols growing up, like fucking Exodus, like Overkill, like Diamond Head, fucking Raven, like the Mentors who I met in Portland. They were on my show, eventually asked me to do a feature film. So I had done a little short piece already for a school project because I eventually went to community college, PCC, and got my video production certificate.
So you did a school project on the Mentors?
Yeah. And we showed it.
You got my respect for that, man. That took a lot of guts.
Well, I tried to present it in a very unbiased way. Like, I'm a woman, you know, so I can show a good perspective from like that side and also put my creative twist on it. And I'm kind of just like a lighthearted, like fun, loving person anyways.
You could talk about the academic aspects of the sandwich of love, you know, like that's great.
Here's the scientific equation.
Yeah. The four H's or whatever.
The whiteboard with the
that's hilarious. So you managed to get to community school.
Yeah. And so but as soon as I went to school, I started picking up gigs. Because I have always been an artist. So I was having art shows in Portland. And then once I started talking about like me studying film, people are like, oh shit, you want a job? Started working art department. art director, production design, like movies, commercials, music videos, all that jazz. And at the end of the Mentors film, we were distributing it, coincidentally, during the height of the Me Too movement.
Oh.
So.
That had to be a problem.
Yeah. So, anyway, that's when I moved to LA. So I moved to LA around then, and then the skate park. Well, I wanted to move to San Pedro because the skate park. So I would have like.
Were you like a skate punk kid? Or? Oh, yeah.
Well, I was more into metal. Yeah. Like I went straight to fucking Pantera. It was like Green Day, Dookie. Oh, Pantera.
It's a different level.
Yeah. I just went amps to 11. So. I mean, so I liked everything, but yeah, I've been skating for about 30 years since I was like 10, 12. Like I just kind of grew up in it.
Right.
And yeah, I'm still doing it.
Hey, oh, that's cool. That's cool.
Mike, you know who Pandera opened up for when they were in New York City?
Oh, recently you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard. I forgot. Who was it?
They opened up for Metallica. They were so loud that people were like deaf before Metallica even went on.
they just wanted to see Pantera.
Yeah, they were there. Like, they were loud.
I heard about that, yeah.
And at that stadium, it was pretty incredible to see them in MetLife.
Well, I remember Dimebag got buried with Eddie Van Halen's guitar.
Yeah.
Remember that? Early 2000s, right?
Yeah. It's been a while already.
I had a ticket to go see Pantera. I grew up like in the 90s, like hitchhiking to the Bay Area to see punk shows or metal shows, like going to Ozfest, you know? I had a ticket to see Pantera and I was in a car accident. We're stupid. Drinking and driving accident put me in the hospital.
Oh, wow.
I never saw Dimebag and I was so pissed at myself.
What are you going to do?
You know, whatever.
Yeah. April, I heard there was a rumor that you had a little acting bug. You were on an episode of NYPD Blue. Is that true?
That's right. I heard that. I must have seen you because I watched that show religiously.
It's funny. No, like when I was in high school, I did theater. And I was a huge theater nerd. I went to like the Shakespeare Festival. I went saw like Phantom of the Opera, you know. But also I got to do art and theater. So I really like the art aspect of it. I thought I wanted to be an actress, so I took some acting classes, and my acting teacher hooked me up with a gig to be an extra on NYPD Blue. I don't even know what episode it was.
Have to find out.
Find it, but that was.
Did you get a credit or no credit?
Well, I should have. I got paid for it, but it was in like 1997. It was in like 1997 before YouTube. Like,
yeah,
I gotta find that. You know, so.
If I find it, I'll send you a screenshot.
All right, yeah. It was in L.A., though. The NYPD Blue. New York was in L.A., the set.
Yeah, they faked that. That was the outside shots were all in New York. I remember watching them film that many times.
Yeah, they used to do a lot like on the Flatiron. I'd seen like Jimmy Smith a bunch of times.
The precinct was right around the corner from the bar right there, the ninth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's cool. That's cool.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, April. You know, tell us a little bit of how you got the Mentors movie together. How did all that go down?
So obviously, the first step to developing the Mentors film was gathering footage from YouTube or whatever, like right, just internet stuff. Like okay, Wikipedia, like research. Go to the Dr. Heathen Scum. He had a box of VHS. Like a whole box, like part of them didn't even work up in Seattle. You know, it's wet in Seattle, like VHS doesn't last. But I sat in his apartment for his condo for like 3 days going through a box of VHS, and there's a VHS and DVD like digitizer. So I put it in, put a blank in, and record the VHS onto DVD. And then I would digitize the DVD into, and I'm like beginning filmmaker. This was like, really advanced technological stuff. Like I grew up poor artist. Like we don't do tech.
No transfers.
VHS DVD was pretty.
And then to digitize the DVD even further. Yeah. It's
So I watched a lot of porn that weekend.
Oh boy, I'm sure he had. He must have had a collection.
A lot of hotel, like, man, I could probably mix a whole Mentor's Porno. That would be a great idea.
Oh man, they're supposed to come on our podcast sometime next month. They're actually on tour.
I know, right?
They're on tour. They were going to Italy or something like that. I got to bring that up. I'll definitely bring up the porn. That'd be funny.
Mike, you know, I had a Mentor shirt, and there was time I couldn't wear it because people would just think I was supporting the clans.
Yeah, because it looks like...
I was like, why are you wearing clans? No, you wore us Mentors. Like, people just didn't get it. It was such an argument. I was like, you know what? Screw these people.
One of the most misunderstood bands ever.
Yeah.
That was so funny. I did get groped by a one-armed midget.
Oh, that's a good accomplishment to talk about.
Yeah.
Like, make this shit up. It's funny because that's the kind of fans the Mentors attract.
Oh, yeah. The total cretins of the world.
Yeah. I was just filming and like I was standing on a chair and he's all, oh, don't worry. I'll make sure you won't fall. I was like, get your stuff off my ass, dude.
Hey, who you think got craziest fans? Gigi Allen or the Mentor?
I don't know. I should have been like a little over to the left.
No, I don't know. That's actually a good question. Gigi fans, I seen Gigi twice, spent the whole both shows in fear for my life. So I don't know if I'm crazy for being there in the first place or what. But I mean, you know, the Mentors, they just, I don't know. I don't think their fans are like that. I mean, they're crazy, but they're not like violent crazy.
You know, the Gigi Allen friend like to get pissed on and get shit on.
Yeah, that's true. Like get shit thrown at you.
Never saw Gigi. I'm a little too young. Like,
Well, you didn't miss much. Most shows lasted about 5 minutes.
When did Gigi die?
He died in 93.
Yeah, see, I was just starting to like go to shows in like 94, 95.
Yeah.
But Merle lives in SoCal, and my band, I wrote a Gigi Allen song, but I changed the word to skateboarding lyrics.
Okay.
So I complained all I just show, and I sent it to him. He's like, this is really awesome. So he gave me his blessing to use it on my album.
Yeah, he's a very cool guy. I like Merle. I've had many conversations with him. That's cool. Yeah. So you get the, you know, all the footage and you put it together. And, you know, were they happy with the finished product?
Yeah, they were. Mm-hmm. They really liked it. It was a pretty gnarly post-production process because I have a job, I'm in school, I'm editing.
Right.
And I'm trying to stay organized and I'm trying to come up with the funding. I mean, I was making like $1,200 a month at this point, like working at a pizza place and like picking up gigs in the film industry. Like sometimes I'd get a killer gig for $500 day rate, but then that was the only one for the entire month, you know? Yeah. So I was just juggling a lot of things. And then one of my dad died. The man who raised me, my brother's father, he passed away. So that was super rough. And then I blew my knee out and then I had to have knee surgery and then I couldn't work.
Oh.
So I was like homeless on crutches, couch surfing, trying to finish this film. Like changing my career because I can't be on set doing production design for 14 hours a day anymore.
Right.
Like what the fuck? And so I was picking up art gigs here and there a little bit. And then eventually I started picking up editing gigs. I knew how to edit, but I didn't have any experience other than like my DIY stuff, you know? So now I work from home full time as a professional creative editor. So it's blessing in disguise, I guess.
So you get, you know, to finance your stuff, you do editing projects, basically, too.
Yeah.
Okay, that's cool.
Dr. Heathen Scum helped produce the film, so he did pitch in financially. Like, he helped me get some camera equipment, and like hard drives are like hundreds, you know, hundreds of dollars.
Crazy. Which,
yeah. So he definitely helped out with that. And then we world premiered it in Helsinki, Finland, and they love the Mentors over there.
What was that the reason why? Because they're so popular there?
Yeah, you know, I think it had a hard time in film festivals because it's not just a low budget. It's like a micro, like backyard budget, mm-hmm. you know? So it's not even like, they consider low budget films to be $200,000. I'm like, oh, this was $8 or something. <You know? laughs> I'm trying the camera and like, you know? So it was, I mean, I don't even know if Heathen's Gump with it that much, but it was pretty low. But I really like how I did on the storytelling, and I'm still learning, you know, it's every job is every story is a never ending learning process.
Right.
So I learned a lot about cameras and storytelling, and then like how to present their story. You know what I mean? Cause like, I'm pro freedom of speech. I don't want to hold back, but I don't want to make them look like, you know, you know, I mean, there was one time I'm like, so sicky wife beater, are you a wife beater?
Yeah.
Like, well,
maybe once, you know.
You know what's funny? A lot of people don't know a bunch of film like that, but Robert Rodriguez, when he did Mariachi, he only had like $15,000, and that movie made like something $6-7 million in him.
That's right. And then, you know, when he did Desperado, he had that huge budget. And I still think El Mariachi is a better movie.
Oh, yeah, El Mariachi was that. But Desperado wasn't bad.
No, it wasn't. You know
what's funny? I think he did the movie under budget, too.
He might have. He's known for that.
Yeah.
I have El Mariachi on VHS, actually.
Great movie.
Yeah, it is a great movie. And, you know, it changed the industry as far as what you could do with a small amount of money.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah.
You know, and I think to go off of piggyback of what you're saying about changing the industry is when I started my Slade in Oregon heavy metal TV series too, like part of it was I'm sick of seeing all these heavy metal publications without all the independent artists. Like, where are the undergrounds? Where are the underdogs?
Yes.
Like, where are the industry? All these Sepultura, like Slipknot, like all these bands. I mean, nothing against Slipknot, but they're fucking everywhere. I don't want to see Slipknot.
Yeah, the only mainstream.
And so I started filming my friends' bands. Mm-hmm. And submitting those short documentaries to the publications, and they wouldn't publish them. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to interview someone big, like fucking Overkill. And then my favorite thrash metal band of all time. Fuck yeah, Bobby Blitz. So then I would do like centered around him. And then at the tail end of the short documentary, I'd insert a couple like local bands that were interviews
established, and then some new bands. Yeah,
and then it worked because I had a big name attached to like the little documentary.
That makes sense.
That was kind of my strategy. I was like, fuck that, you know, because we're all, I mean, the underdogs are the source, like the fuel, the fire of the industry. And so we need to make sure that the underground is represented as much as possible.
So much of the underground, whether it's punk, metal, or whatever, those are the fans too. Okay, the bands are also the fans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you got to have that. So if you don't show both, it's kind of, you know, you're not getting the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so you mentioned your musical background, all that stuff is very cool. What's your film background? What is your influential people in film that you like?
Okay, so, well, growing up, my mom used to make music videos with us kids.
Really?
We dress like whatever, like fucking hippies or whatever, you know. Like little, like VHS. I'm so glad she never learned how to digitize VHS. We're like, no, you ruined my street cred. So, you know, I grew up creative. But growing up, like VH1 Behind the Music was huge inspiration.
Yeah.
I love like VH1 Behind the Music and E! True Hollywood Story. I'll never forget Robert Downey Jr. is like, cocaine 10 times.
Yeah, those were great shows back in the days. Behind the Hollywood and Behind the Music, those were all very great
behind,
shows.
Behind the Music were so well done that you didn't even have to like the band.
Right? Yeah.
You know, it was like, you know, okay, today Behind the Music, Duran Duran, who gives a shit? Sorry, Rob. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Rob likes Duran Duran.
I'm a huge Duran Duran fan. Sorry.
Bad example. But you didn't even have to like the band, and you'd be like, oh, you know what? They'll watch it anyway. You know, it's pretty well done.
They were really good. Yeah. And I don't know, I've always been drawn to documentaries, and it never even occurred to me until like a year ago or a couple years ago that that was probably an influence. I was like, oh my gosh, I was just obsessed with VH1 behind me.
Are there any more like, you know, more mainstream documentary makers you look to, or you pretty much?
Yeah. I mean, then I found out about Penelope Spheeris, you know.
Yeah.
The Decline. So
Decline of Western Civilization, 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah. Yes. So good.
You know, one I grew up
with those. Those were like 1 and 2 I grew up with. That was,
yeah, I've seen those that. Were good.
Rented that at the video store like 8,000 times.
Yeah. And you know, I loved things like Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez, like the really like obscure, kind of risque like stuff. But you know, I'm not a huge like film, like nowadays, I've never been a huge like film nerd. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I like Disney. Oh, Wizard of Oz. That's my favorite film of all time.
Nothing wrong with the Wizard of Oz. That's up there for me and my favorites.
Add some Pink Floyd and some LSD and you're good to go.
Dark Side of the Moon and watch Wizard of Oz. It matches up.
Yeah.
It does.
Hey, you know what? How about we always get the director, Danny Garcia, on the show. He did a bunch of great documentaries.
Yeah, are you familiar with Danny Garcia at all?
The name sounds familiar.
You would love his films. He's a documentary filmmaker mostly. He's done a couple of straight drama action films, but he does mostly musical documentaries. He did the one most recently about the Chelsea Hotel. Okay, I'm in that actually. I tell a story in that movie. And then he did a film.
Max Fish.
What?
The
Max is Kansas City.
Max is Kansas City is another one.
One about the club, Max is Kansas City. But he's done movies about The Clash. He's done movies about Sid and Nancy.
Yeah.
He did a film about Brian Jones from The Stones, like the whole murder mystery thing that he might have been murdered, you know, that whole thing. You got to check his stuff out. A lot of it's available streaming, okay? Yes. But look for it. And he's been on our show a couple of times, Danny Garcia. You would like him.
Okay, Rod, I'm writing that down right now. It sounds familiar. I feel like someone has mentioned him to me.
Yeah.
I love the concept about the Brian Jones thing because I love like mystery like type of stuff.
Yeah. I think it's called Stone, the Brian Jones story, something like that.
Okay, cool.
You know. He's done some like spaghetti Western films. He's from Barcelona.
Yeah. Oh.
Okay. And he's done some like action little things, but he's really known for his documentaries. And they're fantastic. And they're all done super low budget. I don't know how he does it.
Okay? Yeah.
Really like, you know, shoot and run kind of stuff. But it's, you know, he gets a lot of good interviews, especially with the music stuff, like around New York. You know, he's made like a good, He made a great film about Johnny Thunders called Looking for Johnny.
Oh, that was great.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a friend that was in that film too, Rick Rivets. You know, he's managed to get some great people in the New York scene and kind of reuse them again in other films with related stuff. So he's got like this core cast of people that he uses, and it's great. It's great.
That's rad.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned Tarantino before. He's one of my favorites. And really because he's a film buff, a film nerd that made it, that, you know, became what he loved. And, you know, I worked in a video store for a little while, too, when I was like 17. You know, I could have been that guy. You know what I mean? But you know, he's great to me, you know, because it's all the little – all the little nuances, little things that he puts in his film that you're like, wait a minute, that's from this movie from the 70s that I see.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like he's good like that. He puts in little references, you know. You're going to make a straight movie or are you just going to stay with documentaries?
Yeah, on Quentin Tarantino, like such an incredible mind, like innovative, like totally like invented a new genre, you know?
Yeah.
Huge.
Well, you know, I don't know if you remember when he came around. First of all, I saw Reservoir Dogs like I think it was like the second week it was out. Okay. And I actually saw it twice in one day. I went by myself. I heard it was great. Harvey Keitel, who I loved, was in it. And then I said, this is so good. I called a friend of mine up. You know Keith, Rob?
Right? Yes.
I called Keith up, buddy of mine. And I said, you have to come out of the house right now. Come to the city and come see this movie with me. Okay? And he did. And we were just huge fans after that. But, you know, with Tarantino, it's the, like I said, the little nuances and stuff in the movies, little Easter egg things he throws in there. And then it's also the music. He picks his own music.
Yeah.
You know? And what I was going to say is when he first came, there were all these write-ups about how his writing has brought back quality to movies as far as dialogue.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because,
you know, the way the characters in all his films, it doesn't matter if it's Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, or anything now, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you know, that, yeah, that, you know, it, the way the characters bounce off each other in dialogue is just unbelievable. He brought all that back. That was something that was like a film noir 1940s kind of, yeah, way of writing dialogue. He brought that back.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because the attention span these days, it has really kind of like
evolved.
Devolved the, yeah.
Yes.
But which creates more or less attention spans.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, it must be hard to make a movie, and documentary is different because you're dealing with real people telling their story and, mm-hmm, and all that. That's okay. That, I mean, you don't have scripts in documentaries, right? Really. It's just kind of, you have, yeah, ideas like topics.
Yeah. Usually instead of a script is a concept.
Right.
Sometimes I'll do a little bit of screen writings for the concept. If I have an idea for a visual opening shot, you know, okay, what I mean? Like tilt up, pan, Dutch angle, rock focus, like, right, you know, sunset.
But that's not dialogue. That's just like angles and
scenery, like location, sometimes location, like yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, when you're making a regular film, it must be so hard. I don't know how people write scripts to come up with that. You know what I mean? The way you want to go. Then it's the next thing, then the next thing, then like, how does it all come together? I have no idea. I got a lot of respect for filmmakers.
Step by step, day by day.
Right, right. Okay, so you had the Mentors film. It was received pretty well, right? You said in Finland, that's where you started it there, came to the States. Can you get it on DVD?
Yeah, I actually have DVDs for sale. We do have distribution through MVD, music, mm-hmm, video distribution. And, mm-hmm, it's been pretty, I mean, you know, we're not making a ton of money, but sometimes I'll get like a couple hundred bucks in checks. And, you know, I split it with Heathen Scum because he helped pay for the film. And right. So it's a little extra coffee money like every quarter. It's not bad for a first film.
Right.
So, but also during that time, I used my my student card as a way to get into these student clinics for entertainment lawyers.
Oh,
so I was like, I'm a student, so I needed a lawyer to sign off on it. I was like, I don't have permission to use Jerry Springer. I don't have permission to use, you know. But I tried. But some of the stuff was owned by like Sony or like whatever. They're not going to even respond.
Yeah.
But if you present it in a way that is factual and in a way that you cannot tell the story without this information, you could totally, it's, what is it called? It's the Fair Use Act.
Fair use, so, I heard of that.
Fair use for journalists and filmmakers. So it's, you still want to get permission, but it could be a good thing. Like you have to get the Fair Use Act kind of signed off with a lawyer, you know? That Nike logo in the background, like, I mean,
that's why you need the lawyer.
Yeah.
All that. Yeah.
So right. I guess, you know, advice for all those filmmaker students out there, like, use your student card as much as possible. You get free shit, free locations, free actors. Yeah. You know what I mean? Definitely. People want to help too. People like helping.
Sure. People love being in movies.
Yeah.
You know, why would you not want to help?
Yeah.
So this was your first film, the Mentors movie was your first film. And now you've moved over to another project called Concrete Law. And it's a very interesting film about the kind of disintegration of skateboard parks in California, illegal skateboard parks, and which you'll I hope you can explain. Tell us how you got it. I mean, you know, you're obviously you're a skate punk kid, but how did you come up with this topic and you came across it? How did you do that?
Well, it's interesting. When I moved to LA, I was just releasing the Mentors documentary, and I wanted to skate Channel Street Skate Park. Quick history, like in the 90s, there was this rise of this like DIY skate park, like urbanism movement.
Right.
Thousands of skate parks later. Well, I don't know if it's thousands, probably thousands of skate parks later, two decades later.
Right.
These parks are being discovered by government. But yes. They're typically built in the derelict part of town that has been abandoned by the city government anyways. So they're really, you know, it's a fine line between like art, activism, and crime. So anyways, a lot of the cities see these parks and they actually accept them. Like, oh, it's cool. Like there's been a handful, very few have been accepted by the city, but it goes to show like the cities, some cities are accepting of these community built skate parks. I prefer community built rather than illegal, because then that's committing to something.
Right. That leads to a different kind of conversation. Gotcha.
Right. So anyways, the skate park was shut down for 1 year. After that 1 year, they didn't get it back. The city was like, oh, never mind.
Oh.
So we're going to, you know, keep it closed. And it wasn't I kept bugging the guys. I'm like, hey, guys, what's going on? What's the status of the skate park? And the guys are like, well, we don't know. Like, they want us to do all this stuff. We're not really sure. And I'm like, okay. The councilman was getting blown up online at this point, you know? And I was like, okay, what can I do? Like, what can I do? And like, you know, going back to like my goal, I was like, how do I sneak in backstage to get into the show? And I was like, I'll sneak in backstage to reach the fucking council office.
Yeah.
You know, so, cause I had already emailed them. I called their office. I requested an interview. I was like, I'm a journalist and I'm covering this story. Your response or lack thereof will be documented.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I was like, how can I approach it differently? So, and this isn't really in the film. This was a lot of the development phase, but I started going to where the councilman was public speaking, and I'd put a fucking blazer on, brush my hair. And I just started introducing myself to the community, like the government community. I just treated it as like a film networking event.
Right.
Yeah. Like, you know, okay, I get it. Fuck the police, fuck the government. But you know what? Like, I have to go into the lion's den to like make change, you know? So I started introducing myself as an entrepreneur, as a journalist, gaining allies in the city. Eventually I got to the councilman through someone who I had befriended who vouched for me. And I was like, look, I'm not out to make you look bad. If you want to help the skate park, let's show that. But if you're not going to respond, like, we're going to show that too. Like, it's up to you. We can make you look, what, you know, I'm the devil's advocate here.
Right.
Let's make a deal. You know what I mean? Just like with the mentors, like I kind of have to stay like in the middle a little bit. And so he's like, okay, let's do an interview. And I made him look good, whatever. But I did.
You really did make him look good.
Yeah.
You made him look really good.
I did. And he did. This San Pedro Council District 15 was a huge help.
Right.
It took them a long time to like get out of the chair. And my intention was to light a fire under their ass, to make them be like, oh shit, you have an impact journalist on you watching your every fucking move. I wanted to make him paranoid. I wanted to let him know, like, it's not just the community who's watching you. Now it's journalists. Now it's press. And I know press can hurt or make or break a councilman's career.
Right. Now, what was it like working with Tony Hawks?
He's awesome.
Tell the fans out there if they don't know who Tony Hawk is.
So Tony Hawk is a pro skateboarder. He's the Metallica of skateboarding. You're probably living under a rock. Like my grandma knows Tony, you know, knew Tony Hawk was.
A lot of the kids in the city know him from the Tony Hawk pro skater, the video game.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that video game sold millions and millions just on his name alone. So he's a big deal in the industry.
He is. And you know what? Well, it's funny. When I met Tony Hawk, he actually had his head stitched up. Like he had a Band-Aid. Like, I was like, oh, Superman is real, you know? This is before he broke his femur that happened recently and then came back to be nominated for Skater of the Year at age of six. How old is he? 60?
Late
50s, I think.
He's very well respected in the skate community still, which really holds a test of time. But also, his skate advocacy is huge. Like, what he has done for skateboarding is immensely helpful. He started the Skate Park Project, and they have a huge, huge website of resources on how to advocate for yourself as a skateboarder. How to talk to city government, how to not get frustrated and tell government to fuck off, because that's what we do because we're skateboarders, right?
You get fed up.
So he goes into how to get a skate park built in your city, how to launch and initiate that conversation. However, the DIY world is kind of untouched territory because...
He's 55 years old.
Yeah.
Hey, he's like my age. Okay.
Yeah, nice. Catching up with you guys.
Yeah.
But, I forgot where my train of thought was, but. So the DIY realm is a different territory because it's so renegade and there's so much liability and so much risk. So there's not a lot of content on it. But how to legalize a DIY. Every park is different. Every city is different. So there's a couple that have been sanctioned by the city, but they didn't have to go through 10 government agencies to go through the permitting process to navigate bureaucracy, be like, oh no, we made a mistake. We got to go back. Be like, oh, wrong way. And then, so that's like what we did was we just zigzagged and it's still not a good fucking deal. We have to pay $8,000 a year for the skate park to exist with liability insurance, porta potties, dumpsters. But every city built skate park that exists does not have to pay liability insurance because the law states that skateboarding is exempt because it's an extreme sport. However, the city-built skate parks are under a Parks and Recreation jurisdiction, and we are not under Parks and Rec. We're under General Services, so they consider us a building, a business. And so we brought this to insurance companies, and they're like, what is this? They've never seen this. So we had to lie on the insurance company, the place is staffed at all times, and we lock it up at night.
24 hours a day.
Of course we do, yeah. And we do, we clean up shit sometimes. I mean, now that the skate park's open, there's not a lot of that element down there anymore. But there were some meth heads living in the skate park. There was an explosion. Mm. They were living in the shed. It was insane. So it took 7 years for the city.
This thing is under a highway.
Yeah.
Right? On top of, underneath the highway where... You know, you always see in movies in that area, that reservoir kind of area. What do they call that underneath in California? I never know what that's called. But
I don't know.
Yeah.
Under the bridge.
Yeah. You know what I'm talking about, Rob. You always see under the highways in California is those just water under there with side is an incline and people drag race under there in movies and shit.
Yeah. Bridge life, because all the DIYs are under bridges. Not all.
Yes.
Most of them.
Most of them, yeah.
It's perfect. It's a perfect location.
It's good. It's good rain or shine. You cover it up.
Yeah. Even when it's sunny, it's fucking hot.
Not too hot. Yeah. Yeah. Or got the shade above you.
Yeah.
Cool. So when is this film Concrete Law coming out?
So we finished it this 2023. We're submitting to film festivals.
Okay.
We're going to Finland in April. Night Visions Film Festival. I'm still waiting for the official confirmation, but
okay. So you're starting in Finland once again.
Yeah, so they want me back. It's the same film festival. However, there is a skate park in Finland, Helsinki, called Suvilahti DIY. Mm-hmm. They've been around for, I believe, 8 years, and they are scheduled for demolition in July.
Okay.
The film festival is in April.
Yeah.
So I don't know how we can use the film as a tool to help save the skate park. But I reached out to the locals and I offered, I'm like, hey, whatever I can do, let's, you know. They want to replace, the city wants to replace the skate park with an entertainment center. And I looked, I found the blueprints online. And I was like, this entire space is massive. They could totally include a skate park. So if there are any like architects out there who want to like redraw some blueprints, I don't know, maybe that's an idea. Redraw the blueprints for skate park inclusion and then pitch it back to the city.
Right? Have you considered showing it in New York at all?
Yes. Oh yeah. Yeah, I applied. I'm still waiting to hear back from film festivals. But once we have this world premiere, then we could show it anywhere we want. So I'm doing a tour with this, Finland in April. I'm going to Brazil in June. Mm. Road life.
There's a bunch of places in Brooklyn too that have, like, I've seen like very small movies, you know, shown. Film Noir is like one place. I'm trying to think. You got to look like Greenpoint and Williamsburg are like two neighborhoods that have like these little tiny theaters, might hold 50 people. You know, they just show like small films. Danny Garcia, bring him up again. He's had his movies premiered at places like that. Joe's Pub in Manhattan, that's a little bit bigger. That wasn't part of a festival though. When we went, Rob, that the Chelsea movie, that was just his movie.
Yeah, that was just the premiere of his movie at Joe. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, that was a premiere that was supposed to go. I was in the movie The Prep for. And they had the premiere in Brooklyn. I was supposed to go, but I got way too drunk and didn't show up.
Ah, gee, that never happens.
Hey, April, let me ask you about one more thing. What is Shoebox Jones?
It's my thrash metal project.
Tell us about it.
So my drummer is the satanic straight edge vegan in the Mentors film.
Oh, okay.
One of the ex-Mentors drummers.
Satanic straight edge vegan. That's funny.
Yeah. Fantastic.
That's fucking awesome. I forgot about that guy. That's so fucking
awesome. Yeah, he's awesome. For sure. So it's a little thrash project. I actually wrote a song for the film called The Bulldozer's Blade. And it's written in the eyes of a bulldozer who is seeking to destroy DIY skate parks.
So. Was that the song at the end?
Yeah.
At the end of the movie, over the credits. Yeah.
Beware the bulldozer's blade.
Yeah, that was great. This is a cool song. I watched it yesterday. It was great.
You know, I watched the film and I thought it was. It's actually. If you have ADD, it's a very easy film to watch because it keeps your attention, because it goes from one to another subject. But the thing with the permits, Jesus Christ, they did some permit, then they had to do another one. Then they did one, you need this one. It was insane, some of the stuff those guys went through just to get this park legalized. Like, I was watching, Jesus Christ, what did you have to do? And for 7 years, you know, those kids were probably bugging the hell out.
Those kids are adults and have kids now.
Yeah, it's insane.
Like, what the fuck? And it's crazy because there's just like a massive, like, you know, I keep using the word DIY urbanism, like movement that happened in the 90s. And we've seen so many parks get demolished, you know? And I told the councilman, I'm like, dude, these guys, they deserve like a Nobel Peace Prize for providing for your community, providing for these kids and saving parks and rec thousands, probably millions of dollars on maintenance. And this is like $500,000 skate park, easy, like 7,000 square feet.
Yeah.
You know? So what Channel Street has done for the global skate community is just like astronomical. And yeah. and the goal was getting the city to see that. You know, like we know, like we are the community.
Right.
Because we're outsiders that like so part of my strategy was like telling the guys like also like, hey, like if you want to save the skate park, like you have to pretend you're a real nonprofit. You need a website, you need a mission statement, you need a need statement. Let's start writing grants. I went to San Diego State University and got my grant writing certification and came back and was all, what's up? Let's write some grants now and do like youth programming and youth giveaways and you know, work with underserved kids and stuff. So we've been doing that every year. It's been really fun.
Yeah, if you ever look at New York City, they got a few skate parks, and they're all in the park and recreation. Like, they take pretty good care of it, and there's always kids. Like, a lot of the parks from the west side
yep.
to even all the way downtown, they pretty much now incorporate some kind of skate for them.
Yeah, Parks and Recreation Department.
Yeah.
They handle it.
But now, with my research, I'm finding that, well, there's multiple skate parks in jeopardy at the moment. That's already been around for a decade or two. It's crazy. But also I'm finding out about laws in other states where the policy states in one state, I think it's Michigan, cannot, it's illegal to skateboard after dark. In Wisconsin, it's illegal to skateboard on the sidewalk or the road or as transportation because the law states it's the same category as a toy sled. And I'm like, when was this policy written? When that's, it was a toy sled in like the 50s?
From like 75 years ago, yeah.
So yeah, there's actually two politicians that are like working with their skateboarders to change the policy. And so I started diving into the whole policy and restrictions on skateboarding throughout history. And there was a man called Jim Fitzpatrick, who's a skater from the 50s. He's almost 80 now.
Wow.
In the 80s. He went to the courts and changed the policy laws for skateboarding because hundreds of parks were demolished in the 80s because of the policy laws, the insurance laws.
Right.
So it's just like, I'm going down this rabbit hole of like, fuck, let's go to war. Let's change this shit. It's in right. the Olympics
you're like now. You're like a total authority on all this now, man. That's amazing.
I'm just a hellraiser, you know?
Yeah, you are. You are. Take no shit.
Take no prisoners.
What I think too is like, you know, it seems in California, you would have more people open to, you know, saving the parks. Okay. Back here on the East Coast or New York City, shit, man, they want to knock something down. They knock it down. They don't care. They'll have like a fake hearing and they'll say, okay, speak your mind. And then just doing it anyway. See you later.
Yeah, it's insane. It's insane.
During the hearing, when everyone's at the hearing.
Yeah, you come out of the hearing and the skateboard park is gone. Yeah, that's exactly what happened in New York City. Exactly.
So on one side of the spectrum, you have skateboarding, this illegal, renegade, underground skateboarding, which is really part of the roots of skateboarding.
Yeah.
That we see today. And then you have the Olympics. Oh! Like, what? There's no reason we should be tearing out community-built hubs. You know?
Yeah. Agreed. Definitely. So what do you got coming up after this? You have anything in line or any projects?
Yes. Yeah, so it's in the development. There's always development projects.
Okay. Can you talk about it?
Yeah. So in the same vein of this Concrete Law film, I've been researching on just policy and skateboarding, right? So my next project delves into an in-depth examination of government policies and constraints on skateboarding over time. It highlights the advocates and change makers who have advanced the evolution of the skateboard industry.
Interesting.
I read that. Could you see me?
Yeah, yeah. I think you were reading.
My eyes were like...
I'll pretend I didn't see your eyes.
Okay.
That's good. That's good.
So I'm on that mission, but I'm going to use my films, film festivals, and me traveling to create an impact campaign to offer my film as a tool to help save skate parks. You know, and we're still figuring out what works, what doesn't work. If we could spread any educational you know, experiences along the way, help these parks raise funding, like whatever. But I'm also going to use my travel to interview people in the community and just to see like policy change over time and how it's affecting skateboarding today and kind of, you know, it's still in development, but
gotcha.
It's in the works.
That sounds very interesting. Very interesting. Okay, April, thank you for coming on. April Jones, film director. Concrete Lore is the latest that's going to be coming out. What's the date? The film, the you don't know yet, right?
Oh, Night Visions Film Festival, April 2024.
Oh, okay. Okay, so 2 months.
Streaming might be late 2024. Okay. We got to do the film festival.
What is the date again?
April 2024.
That's this year, Rob.
I know. I was hoping it was. I was hoping it was 420.
420. Could be 420/24.
That would go with the skating. That would go with the whole community if you open at 420.
420. Yeah. So I'll see you guys in New York sometime this year, hopefully.
Well, listen, when you do, you got a bar stool waiting for you and some drinks, and we'll be there for you. You let us know.
Hell yeah.
Bob is a bartender in the East Village. I'm a drunk in the East Village, and I will, you know, meet you. We'll have a couple of drinks, talk about skateboarding.
Hell yeah, I'm ready to rock. Wow.
Cool. All right, April, thank you for coming on the Rocker Mike and Rob Presents Show. Very interesting stuff. Concrete Lore is the film coming out in April of this year, very soon. Take a
very
look
soon.
Rob, what do we always say at the end of every show?
We don't get drunk.
We get lumped up.
We'll see you next time.
Take care.
I'm getting lumped up with Rocker Mike and Rob Rossi. I'm getting lumped up with Rocker Mike and Rob Rossi. Well, I'm lumped up, but I'm okay. It's gonna get lumped up anyway. You better call back the posse. Just getting lumped up with Rocker Mike and Rob Rossi.